Chapter 14. Stocks, Bonds, and Insurance. Risk-taking is the mother's milk of capitalism. Wall Street Journal. Risks inherent in economic activities can be dealt with in a wide variety of ways. In addition to the commodity speculation and inventory management discussed in the previous chapter, other ways of dealing with risk include stocks and bonds. There are also other economic activities analogous to stocks and bonds, which deal with risks in ways that are legally different, though similar economically. Whenever a home, a business, or any other asset increases in value over time, that increase is called a capital gain. While it is another form of income, it differs from wages and salaries in not being paid right after it is earned, but usually only after an interval of some years. A 30-year bond, for example, can be cashed in only after 30 years. If you never sell your home, then whatever increase in value it has will be called an unrealized capital gain. The same is true for someone who opens a grocery store that grows more valuable as its location becomes known throughout the neighborhood, and as it develops a set of customers who get into the habit of shopping at that particular store. Perhaps after the owner dies, the surviving spouse or children may decide to sell the store. And only then will the capital gain be realized. Sometimes a capital gain comes from a purely financial transaction, where you simply pay someone a certain amount of money today in order to get back a somewhat larger amount of money later on. This happens when you put money into a savings account that pays interest, or when a pawnbroker lends money, or when you buy a $10,000 U.S. Treasury bond for somewhat less than $10,000. However it is done, this is a trade-off of money today for money in the future. The fact that interest is paid implies that money today is worth more than the same amount of money in the future. How much more depends on many things and varies from time to time, as well as from country to country at the same time. In the heyday of 19th century British industrialization, railroad companies could raise the huge sums of money required to build miles of tracks and buy trains by selling bonds that paid about 5% per year. This was possible only because the public had great confidence in both the railroads and the stability of the money. If the rate of inflation had been 6% a year, those who bought the bonds would have lost real value instead of gaining it. But the value of the British pound sterling was very stable and reliable during that era. Since those times, inflation has become more common, so the interest rate would now have to cover whatever level of inflation was expected and still leave a prospect of a real gain in terms of an increase in purchasing power. The risk of inflation varies from country to country and from one era to another, so the rate of return on investments must include an allowance for the risk of inflation, which also varies. At the beginning of the 21st century, Mexico's government bonds paid 2.5 percentage points higher interest than those of the United States, while those of Brazil paid 5 percentage points higher than those of Mexico. Brazil's interest rate then shot up another 10 percentage points after the emergence of a left-wing candidate for president of the country. In short, varying risks, of which inflation is just one, are reflected in varying risk premiums added on to the underlying pure interest rate, which is a payment for postponed repayment. The risk premium component included in what is more loosely and more generally called the interest rate can become larger than what economists might call the pure interest rate. As of April 2003, for example, short-term interest rates, in the more general sense, ranged from less than 2% in Hong Kong to 18% in Russia and 39% in Turkey. Leaving inflation aside, how much would a $10,000 bond that matures a year from now be worth to you today? That is, how much would you bid today for a bond that can be cashed in for $10,000 next year? Clearly, it would not be worth $10,000 because future money is not as valuable as the same amount of present money. Even if you felt certain that you would still be alive a year from now, and even if there were no inflation expected, you would still prefer to have the same amount of money right now rather than later. If nothing else, money that you have today can be put in a bank and earn a year's interest on it. For the same reason, if you had a choice between buying a bond that matures a year from now and another bond of the same face value that matures 10 years from now, you would not be willing to bid as much for the one that matures a decade later. What this says is that the same nominal amount of money has different values, depending on how long you must wait to receive it. At a sufficiently high interest rate, you might be willing to wait decades to get your money back. People buy 30-year bonds regularly, though usually at a higher rate of return than what is paid on financial securities that mature in a year. On the other hand, at a sufficiently low interest rate, you would not be willing to wait any time at all to get your money back. Somewhere in between is an interest rate at which you would be indifferent between lending money or keeping it. At that interest rate, the present value of a given amount of future money is equal to some smaller amount of present money. For example, if you are indifferent at 4%, then $100 today is worth $104 a year from now to you. Any business or government agency that wants to borrow $100 from you today with a promise to pay you back a year from now will have to make that repayment at least $104. If everyone else has the same preferences that you do, then the interest rate in the economy as a whole will be 4%. What if everyone does not have the same preferences that you do? Suppose that others will lend only when they get back 5% more at the end of the year. In that case, the interest rate in the economy as a whole will be 5%, simply because businesses and government cannot borrow the money they want for any less, and they do not have to offer any more. Faced with a national interest rate of 5%, you would have no reason to accept less, even though you would take 4% if you had to. In this situation, let us return to the question of how much you would be willing to bid for a $10,000 bond that matures a year from now. With an interest rate of 5% being available in the economy as a whole, it would not pay you to bid more than $9,523.81 for a $10,000 bond that matures a year from now. By investing that same amount of money somewhere else today at 5%, you could get back $10,000 in a year. Therefore, there is no reason for you to bid more than $9,523.81 for the $10,000 bond. What if the interest rate in the economy as a whole had been 12% rather than 5%? Then it would not pay you to bid more than $8,928.57 for a $10,000 bond that matures a year from now. In short, what people will bid for bonds depends on how much they could get for the same money by putting it somewhere else. That is why bond prices go down when the interest rate goes up, and vice versa. What this also says is that when the interest rate is 5%, $9,523.81 in the year 2014 is the same as $10,000 in the year 2015. This raises questions about the taxation of capital gains. If someone buys a bond for the former price and sells it a year later for the latter price, the government will, of course, want to tax the $476.19 difference. But is that really the same as an increase in value, if the two sums of money are just equivalent to one another? What if there has been a 1% inflation, so that the $10,000 received back would not have been enough to compensate for waiting, if the investor had expected inflation to reduce the real value of the bond? What if there had been a 5% inflation, so that the amount received back was worth no more than the amount originally lent, with no reward at all for waiting for the postponed repayment? Clearly, the investor would be worse off than if he or she had never bought the bond. How then can this capital gain really be said to be a gain? These are just some of the considerations that make the taxation of capital gains more complicated than the taxation of such other forms of income as wages and salaries. Some governments in some countries do not tax capital gains at all, while the rate at which such gains are taxed in the United States remains a matter of political controversy. Variable returns versus fixed returns. There are many ways of confronting the fact that the real value of a given sum of money varies with when it is received and with the varying likelihood that it will be received at all. Stocks and bonds are among the many ways of dealing with differing risks. But people who are not considering buying these financial securities must nevertheless confront the same principles in other ways when choosing a career for themselves or when considering public policy issues for the country as a whole. Stocks versus bonds. Bonds differ from stocks because bonds are legal commitments to pay fixed amounts of money on a fixed date. Stocks are simply shares of the business that issues them. and there is no guarantee that the business will make a profit in the first place, much less pay out dividends instead of reinvesting their profits in the business itself. Bondholders have a legal right to be paid what they were promised, whether the business is making money or losing money. In that respect, they are like the business's employees, to whom fixed commitments have been made as to how much they would be paid per hour or per week or month. They are legally entitled to those amounts, regardless of whether the business is profitable or unprofitable. The owners of a business, whether that is a single individual or millions of stockholders, are not legally entitled to anything, except whatever happens to be left over after a business has paid its employees, bondholders, and other creditors. Considering the fact that most new businesses fail within a few years, what is left over can just as easily be negative as positive. In other words, people who set up businesses may not only fail to make a profit, but may even lose part or all of what they originally invested. In short, stocks and bonds have different amounts of risk. Moreover, the mixture of stocks and bonds sold by different kinds of businesses may reflect the inherent risks of these businesses themselves. Imagine that someone is raising money to go into a business where, one, the chances are 50-50 that he will go bankrupt, and two, if the business does survive financially, the value of the initial investment will increase tenfold. Perhaps the entrepreneur is drilling for oil or speculating in foreign currencies. What if the entrepreneur wants you to contribute $5,000 to this venture? Would you be better off buying $5,000 worth of stock in this enterprise or $5,000 worth of this company's bonds? If you buy bonds, your chances are still only 50-50 of getting all your money back. And if this enterprise prospers, you are only entitled to whatever rate of return was specified in the bond at the outset, no matter how many millions of dollars the entrepreneur makes with your money. Buying bonds in such a venture would obviously not be a worthwhile deal. Buying stocks, on the other hand, might make sense, if you can afford the risk. If the business goes bankrupt, your stock could be worthless, while a bond would have some residual value based on whatever assets might remain to be sold, even if that only pays the bondholders and other creditors pennies on the dollar. On the other hand, if the business succeeds and its assets increase tenfold, then the value of your stock likewise increases tenfold. This is the kind of investment often called venture capital, as distinguished from buying the stocks or bonds of some long-established corporation that is unlikely to either go bankrupt or to have a spectacular rate of return on its investments. As a rule of thumb, it has been estimated that a venture capitalist needs at least a 50% rate of return on successful investments in order to cover the losses on the many unsuccessful investments and still come out ahead overall. In real life, rates of return on venture capital can vary greatly from year to year. For the 12 months ending September 30, 2001, venture capital funds lost 32.4%. That is, not only did these venture capitalists as a whole not make any net profit, they lost nearly one-third of the money they had invested. But just a couple of years earlier, venture capitalists averaged a rate of return of 163%. The question of whether this kind of activity is worthwhile, from the standpoint of the venture capitalist, can be left to the venture capitalist to worry about. From the standpoint of the economy as a whole, the question is whether this kind of financial activity represents an efficient allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. Although individual venture capitalists can go bankrupt, just like the companies they invest in, the venture capital industry as a whole usually does not lose money. That is, it does not waste the available resources of the economy. It is, in fact, remarkable that something which looks as risky as venture capital usually works out from the standpoint of the economy as a whole, even if not from the standpoint of each venture capitalist. Now look at stocks and bonds from the standpoint of the entrepreneur who is trying to raise money for a risky undertaking. Knowing that bonds would be unattractive to investors and that a bank would likewise be reluctant to lend to him because of the high risks, the entrepreneur would almost certainly try to raise money by selling stocks instead. At the other end of the risk spectrum, consider a public utility that supplies something for which the public has a continuing demand, such as water or electricity. There is usually very little risk involved in putting money into such an enterprise, so the utility can issue and sell bonds without having to pay the higher amounts that investors would earn on stocks. In recent years, some pension funds seeking safe, long-run investments from which to pay their retirees have invested in the building of toll highways, from whose receipts they can expect a continuing stream of returns for years to come. In short, risks vary among businesses, and their financial arrangements vary accordingly. At one extreme, a commodity speculator can go from profits to losses and back again, not only from year to year, but even from hour to hour on a given day. That is why there are television pictures of frantic shouting and waving in commodity exchanges, where prices are changing so rapidly that the difference between making a deal right now and making it 5 minutes from now can be vast sums of money. A more common pattern among those businesses that succeed is one of low income or no income at the beginning, followed by higher earnings after the enterprise develops a clientele and establishes a reputation. For example, a dentist first starting out in his profession after graduating from dental school and buying the costly equipment needed to get started may have little or no net income the first year before becoming known widely enough in the community to attract a large clientele. During that interim, the dentist's secretary may be making more money than the dentist. Later on, of course, the situation will reverse, and some observers may then think it unfair that the dentist makes several times the income of the secretary. Even when variable sums of money add up to the same total as fixed sums of money, they are unlikely to be equally attractive. Would you be equally as likely to enter two occupations with the same average income, say $50,000 a year, over the next decade, if one occupation paid $50,000 every year, while the income in the other occupation might vary from $10,000 one year to $90,000 the next year and back again in an unpredictable pattern? Chances are you would require a somewhat higher average income in the occupation with variable pay to make it equally attractive with the occupation with a reliably fixed income. Accordingly, stocks usually yield a higher average rate of return than bonds, since stocks have a variable rate of return, including, sometimes, no return at all, while bonds have a guaranteed fixed rate of return. It is not some moral principle that makes this happen. It happens because people will not take the risk of buying stocks unless they can expect a higher average rate of return than they get from bonds. The degree of risk varies not only with the kind of investment, but also with the period of time involved. For a period of 1 year, bonds are likely to be much safer than stocks. But for a period of 20 or 30 years, the risk of inflation threatens the value of bonds or other assets with fixed dollar amounts, such as bank accounts, while stock prices tend to rise with inflation, like real estate, factories, or other real assets. Being shares of real assets, stocks rise in price as the assets themselves rise in price during inflation. Therefore, the relative safety of stocks and bonds can be quite different in the long run than in the short run. Someone planning for retirement decades in the future may find a suitable mixture of stocks a much safer investment than someone who will need the money in a year or two. Like money in the bank is a popular phrase used to indicate something that is a very safe bet, but money in the bank is not particularly safe over a period of decades when inflation can steal much of its value. The same is true of bonds. Eventually, after reaching an age when the remaining life expectancy is no longer measured in decades, it may be prudent to begin transferring money out of stocks and into bonds, bank accounts, and other assets with greater short-run safety. Risk and time. The stock market as a whole is not as risky as commodity speculation or venture capital, but neither is it a model of stability. Even during a boom in the economy and in stocks, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which measures movements in the stocks of major corporations, can go down on a given day. In the entire history of the American stock market, the longest streak of consecutive business days when the Dow Jones average ended up higher was 14, back in 1897. In 2007, the Wall Street Journal reported, "Until yesterday, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was on its longest winning streak since 2003, up for 8 straight sessions. Had it continued one more day, it would have been the longest streak in more than a decade." Yet the media often report the ups and downs of the stock market as if it were big news, sometimes offering guesses for a particular day's rise or fall. But stock prices around the world have been going up and down for centuries. As an extreme example of how the relative risks of different kinds of investments can vary over time, a dollar invested in bonds in 1801 would have been worth nearly $1,000 by 1998, while a dollar invested in stocks that same year would have been worth more than $500,000. All this is in real terms, taking inflation into account. Meanwhile, a dollar invested in gold in 1801 would in 1998 be worth just 78 cents. The phrase "as good as gold" can be misleading as the phrase "money in the bank" when talking about the long run. While there have been many short-run periods when bonds and gold held their values as stock prices plummeted, the relative safety of these different kinds of investments varies greatly with how long a time period you have in mind. Moreover, the pattern is not the same in all eras. The real rate of return on American stocks was just 3.6% during the Depression decade from 1931 to 1940, while bonds paid 6.4%. However, bonds had a negative rate of return in real terms during the succeeding decades of the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, while stocks had positive rates of return during that era. In other words, money invested in bonds during those inflationary decades would not buy as much when these bonds were cashed in as when the bonds were bought, even though larger sums of money were received in the end. With the restoration of price stability in the last two decades of the 20th century, both stocks and bonds had positive rates of real returns. But during the first decade of the 21st century, all that changed, as the New York Times reported. If you invested $100,000 on January 1, 2000, in the Vanguard Index Fund that tracks the Standard & Poor's 500, you would have ended up with $89,072 by mid-December of 2009. Adjust that for inflation by putting it in January 2000 and you're left with $69,114. With a more diversified portfolio and a more complex investment strategy, however, the original $100,000 investment would have grown to $313,747 over the same time period, worth $260,102 in January 2000, taking inflation into account. Risk is always specific to the time at which a decision is made. Hindsight is 20/20, but risk always involves looking forward, not backward. During the early financially shaky years of McDonald's, the company was so desperate for cash at one point that its founder, Ray Kroc, offered to sell half interest in McDonald's for $25,000, and no one accepted his offer. If anyone had, that person would have become a billionaire over the years. But at the time, it was neither foolish for Ray Kroc to make that offer, nor for others to turn it down. The relative safety and profitability of various kinds of investments also depends on your own knowledge. An experienced expert in financial transactions may grow rich speculating in gold, while people of more modest knowledge are losing big. However, with gold, you are unlikely to be completely wiped out, since gold always has a value for jewelry and industrial uses, while any given stock can end up not worth the paper it is written on. Nor is it only novices who lose money in the stock market. In 2001, the 400 richest Americans lost a total of $283 billion. Risk and diversification. The various degrees and varieties of risk can be dealt with by having a variety of investments, a portfolio, as they say, so that when one kind of investment is not doing well, other kinds may be flourishing, thereby reducing the overall risk to your total assets. For example, as already noted, bonds may not be doing well during a period when stocks are very profitable, or vice versa. A portfolio that includes a combination of stocks and bonds may be much less risky than investing exclusively in either. Even adding an individually risky investment like gold, whose price is very volatile, to a portfolio can reduce the risk of the portfolio as a whole, since gold prices tend to move in the opposite direction from stock prices. A portfolio consisting mostly, or even solely, of stocks can have its risks reduced by having a mixture of stocks from different companies. These may be a group of stocks selected by a professional investor who charges others for selecting and managing their money in what is called a mutual fund, where the selection of stocks bought by the mutual fund is simply a mixture based on whatever stocks make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the Standard & Poor's Index, then there is less management required and less may be charged for the service. Mutual funds manage vast sums of investors' money. More than 50 mutual funds have assets of at least $10 billion each. Theoretically, those mutual funds where the managers actively follow the various markets and then pick and choose which stocks to buy and sell should average a higher rate of return than those mutual funds which simply buy whatever stocks happen to make up the Dow Jones Average or Standard & Poor's Index. Some actively managed mutual funds do in fact do better than index mutual funds, but in many years the index funds have had higher rates of return than most of the actively managed funds, much to the embarrassment of the latter. In 2005, for example, of 1,137 actively managed mutual funds dealing in large corporate stocks, just 55.5% did better than the Standard & Poor's Index. On the other hand, the index funds offer little chance of a big killing, such as a highly successful actively managed fund might. A reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who recommended index funds for people who don't have the time or the confidence to buy their own stocks individually, said, "True, you might not laugh all the way to the bank, but you will probably smile smugly." However, index mutual funds lost 9% of their value in the year 2000, so there is no complete freedom from risk anywhere. For mutual funds as a whole, both managed funds and index funds, a $10,000 investment in early 1998 would by early 2003 be worth less than $9,000. Out of 1,000 established mutual funds, just one made money every year of the decade ending in 2003. What matters, however, is whether they usually make money. While mutual funds made their first appearance in the last quarter of the 20th century, the economic principles of risk spreading have long been understood by those investing their own money. In centuries past, ship owners often found it more prudent to own 10% of 10 different ships, rather than own one ship outright. The dangers of a ship sinking were much greater in the days of wooden ships and sails than in the modern era of metal, mechanically powered ships. Owning 10% shares in 10 different ships increased the danger of a loss through a sinking of at least one of those ships, but greatly reduced how catastrophic that loss would be. Investing in human capital. Investing in human capital is in some ways similar to investing in other kinds of capital, and in some ways different. People who accept jobs with no pay, or with pay much less than they could have gotten elsewhere, are in effect investing their working time, rather than money, in hopes of a larger future return than they would get by accepting a job that pays a higher salary initially. But where someone invests in another person's human capital, the return on this investment is not as readily recovered by the investor. Typically, those who use other people's money to pay for their education, for example, either receive that money as a gift from parents, philanthropic individuals or organizations, or from the government, or else borrow the money. While students can, in effect, issue bonds, they seldom issue stocks. That is, many students go into debt to pay for their education, but rarely sell percentage shares of their future earnings. In the few cases where students have done the latter, they have often felt resentful in later years at having to continue contributing a share of their income after their payments have already covered all of the initial investment made in them. But dividends from corporations that issue stock likewise continue to be paid in disregard of whether the initial purchase price of the stock has already been repaid. That is the difference between stocks and bonds. It is misleading to look at this situation only after an investment in human capital is paid off. Stocks are issued precisely because of risks that the investment will not pay off. Given that a substantial number of college students will never graduate, and that even some of those who do may have meager incomes, the pooling of risks enables more private financing to be made available to college students in general. Ideally, if prospective students could and did issue both stocks and bonds in themselves, it would be unnecessary for parents or taxpayers to subsidize their education, and even poverty-stricken students could go to the most expensive colleges without financial aid. However, legal problems, institutional inertia, and social attitudes have kept such arrangements from becoming widespread in colleges and universities. When Yale University in the 1970s offered loans whose future repayment amounts varied with the students' future earnings, those students who were going into law, business, and medicine, usually would not borrow money from the university under this program, since their high anticipated incomes would mean paying back far more than was borrowed. They preferred issuing bonds rather than stock. In some kinds of endeavors, however, it is feasible to have human beings in effect issue both stocks and bonds in themselves. Boxing managers have often owned percentage shares of their fighters' earnings. Thus, many poor youngsters have received years of instruction in boxing that they would have been unable to pay for. Nor would simply going into debt to pay for this instruction be feasible, because the risks are too high for lenders to lend in exchange for a fixed repayment. Some boxers never make it to the point where their earnings from fighting would enable them to repay the costs of their instruction and management. Nor are such boxers likely to have alternative occupations from which they could repay large loans to cover the costs of their failed boxing careers. Professional boxers are more likely to have been in prison or on welfare than to have a college degree. Given the low-income backgrounds from which most boxers have come, and the high risk that they will never make any substantial amount of money, financing their early training in effect by stocks makes more sense than financing it by bonds. A fight manager can collect a dozen young men from tough neighborhoods as boxing prospects, knowing that most will never repay his investment of time and money, but calculating that a couple probably will, if he has made wise choices. Since there is no way to know in advance which ones these will be, the point is to have enough financial gains from shares in the winning fighters to offset the losses on the fighters who never make enough money to repay the investment. For similar reasons, Hollywood agents have acquired percentage shares in the future earnings of unknown young actors and actresses who looked promising, thus making it worthwhile to invest time and money in the development and marketing of their talent. The alternative of having these would-be movie stars pay for this service by borrowing the money would be far less feasible, given the high risk that the majority who fail would never be able to repay the loans and might well disappear after it was clear that they were going nowhere in Hollywood. At various times and places, it has been common for labor contractors to supply teams of immigrant laborers to work on farms, factories, or construction sites in exchange for a percentage share of their earnings. In effect, the contractor owns stock in the workers rather than bonds. Such workers have often been both very poor and unfamiliar with the language and customs of the country, so that their prospects of finding their own jobs individually have been very unpromising. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, vast numbers of contract laborers from Italy went to countries in the Western Hemisphere, and contract laborers from China went to countries in Southeast Asia, while contract laborers from India spread around the world to British Empire countries, from Malaysia to Fiji to British Guiana. In short, investment in human capital, as in other capital, has been made in the form of stocks as well as bonds. Although these are not the terms usually applied, that is what they amount to economically. Insurance. Many things are called insurance, but not all of those things are in fact insurance. After first dealing with the principles on which insurance has operated for centuries, we can then see the difference between insurance and various other programs which have arisen in more recent times and have been called insurance in political rhetoric. Insurance in the marketplace. Like commodity speculators, insurance companies deal with inherent and inescapable risks. Insurance both transfers and reduces those risks. In exchange for the premium paid by its policyholder, the insurance company assumes the risk of compensating for losses caused by automobile accidents, houses catching fire, earthquakes, hurricanes, and numerous other misfortunes that befall human beings. There are nearly 36,000 insurance carriers in the United States alone. In addition to transferring risks, an insurance company seeks to reduce them. For example, it charges lower prices to safe drivers and refuses to insure some homes until brush and other flammable materials near a house are removed. People working in hazardous occupations are charged higher premiums. In a variety of ways, insurance companies segment the population and charge different prices to people with different risks. That way, it reduces its own overall risks and, in the process, sends a signal to people working in dangerous jobs or living in dangerous neighborhoods conveying to them the costs created by their chosen activity, behavior, or location. The most common kind of insurance, life insurance, compensates for a misfortune that cannot be prevented. Everyone must die, but the risk involved is in the time of death. If everyone were known in advance to die at age 80, there would be no point in life insurance because there would be no risk involved. Each individual's financial affairs could be arranged in advance to take that predictable time of death into account. Paying premiums to an insurance company would make no sense because the total amount to which those premiums grew over the years would have to add up to an amount no less than the compensation to be received by one's surviving beneficiaries. A life insurance company would, in effect, become an issuer of bonds redeemable on fixed dates. Buying life insurance at age 20 would be the same as buying a 60-year bond, and buying life insurance at age 30 would be the same as buying a 50-year bond. What makes life insurance different from a bond is that neither the individual insured nor the insurance company knows when that particular individual will die. The financial risks to others that accompany the death of a family breadwinner or business partner are transferred to the insurance company for a price. Those risks are also reduced because the average death rate among millions of policyholders is far more predictable than the death of any given individual. As with other forms of insurance, risks are not simply transferred from one party to another, but reduced in the process. That is what makes buying and selling an insurance policy a mutually beneficial transaction. The insurance policy is worth more to the buyer than it costs the seller because the seller's risk is less than the risk that the buyer would face without insurance. Where a given party has a large enough sample of risks, there may be no benefit from buying an insurance policy. The Hertz Car Rental Agency, for example, owns so many automobiles that its risks are sufficiently spread that it need not pay an insurance company to assume those risks. It can use the same statistical methods used by insurance companies to determine the financial costs of its risks and incorporate that cost into what it charges people who rent their cars. There is no point transferring a risk that is not reduced in the process, because the insurer must charge as much as the risk would cost the insured, plus enough more to pay the administrative costs of doing business, and still leave a profit to the insurer. Self-insurance is therefore a viable option for those with a large enough sample of risks. Insurance companies do not simply save the premiums they receive and later pay them out when the time comes. In 2012, for example, more than half the current premiums on homeowners insurance were paid out in current claims, 60% by State Farm and 53% by Allstate. Insurance companies can then invest what is left over after paying claims and other costs of doing business. Because of these investments, the insurance companies will have more money available than if they had let the money they received from policyholders gather dust in a vault. About two-thirds of life insurance companies' income comes from the premiums paid by their policyholders, and about one-fourth from earnings on their investments. Obviously, the money invested has to be put into relatively safe investments, government securities and conservative real estate loans, for example, rather than commodity speculation. If, over a period of 10 years, you pay a total of $9,000 in premiums for insurance to cover some property, and then suffer $10,000 in property damages that the insurance company must pay for, it might seem that the insurance company has lost money. If, however, your $9,000 in premium payments have been invested and have grown to $12,000 by the time you require reimbursement for property damage, then the insurance company has come out $2,000 ahead. According to The Economist magazine, premiums alone are rarely enough to cover claims and expenses. And in the United States, this has been true of property casualty insurers for the past 25 years. In 2004, automobile and property insurers in the United States made a profit from the actual insurance underwriting itself for the first time since 1978. While it might seem that an insurance company could just keep the profit from its investments for itself, in reality, competition forces the price of insurance down, as it forces other prices down, to a level that will cover costs and provide a rate of return sufficient to compensate investors without attracting additional competing investment. In an economy where investors are always on the lookout for higher profits, an inflated rate of profit in the insurance industry would tend to cause new insurance companies to be created in order to share in this bonanza. There are already many competitors in the insurance industry, none of them dominant. Among American property and casualty insurance companies in 2010, the four largest, put together, collected just 28% of the premiums, while the next 46 largest insurance companies collected 52%. The role of competition in forcing prices and profits into line can be seen in the decline of the price of term life insurance after an internet website began to list all the insurance companies providing this service and their respective prices. Other changes in circumstances are also reflected in changing prices as a result of competition. For example, when the large baby boomer generation became middle-aged, their declining automobile accident rates as they moved into the safest age brackets were reflected in the ending of the sharply rising automobile insurance rates in previous years. Crackdowns on automobile insurance frauds also helped. With insurance, as with advertising, the costs paid do not simply add to the price of products sold by a business that is insured. With advertising, as noted in Chapter 6, the increased sales that it produces can allow a business and its customers to benefit from economies of scale that produce lower prices. In the case of insurance, the risk that it insures against would have to be covered in the price of the product sold if there were no insurance. Since the whole point of buying insurance is to reduce risk, the cost of the insurance has to be less than the cost of the uninsured risk. Therefore, the cost of producing the insured product is less than the cost of producing the product without insurance, so that the price tends to be lower than it would be if the risk had to be guarded against by charging higher prices. Moral hazard and adverse selection. While insurance generally reduces risks as it transfers them, there are also risks created by the insurance itself. Someone who is insured may then engage in more risky behavior than if he or she were not insured. An insured motorist may park a car in a neighborhood where the risk of theft or vandalism would be too great to risk parking an uninsured vehicle. Jewelry that is insured may not be as carefully kept under lock and key as if it were uninsured. Such increased risk as a result of having insurance is known as moral hazard. Such changes in behavior, as a result of having insurance, make it more difficult to calculate the right premium to charge. If one out of every 10,000 automobiles suffers $1,000 worth of damage from vandalism annually, then it might seem as if charging each of the 10,000 motorists 10 cents more to cover damage from vandalism would be sufficient. However, if insured motorists become sufficiently careless that one out of every 5,000 cars now suffers the same damage from vandalism, then the premium would need to be twice as large to cover the costs. In other words, statistics showing how motorists currently behave and what damages they currently incur may underestimate what damages they will incur after they are insured. That is what makes moral hazard a hazard to the insurance companies and a source of higher premiums to those who buy insurance. For similar reasons, knowing what percentage of the population comes down with a given illness can also be misleading as to how much it would cost to sell insurance to pay for treatment of that illness. If one out of every 100,000 people comes down with disease X and the average cost of treating that disease is $10,000, it might seem that adding insurance coverage for disease X to a policy would cost the insurance company only an additional 10 cents per policy. But what if some people are more likely to get that disease than others, and those people know it? What if people who work in and around water are more likely to come down with this disease than people who work in dry, air-conditioned offices? Then fishermen, lifeguards, and sailors are more likely to buy this insurance coverage than our secretaries, executives, or computer programmers. People living in Hawaii would be more likely to buy insurance coverage for this disease than people living in Arizona. This is known as adverse selection because statistics on the incidence of disease X in the population at large may seriously underestimate its incidence among the kinds of people who are likely to buy insurance coverage for a disease that is more likely to strike people living or working near water. Although determining costs and probabilities for various kinds of insurance involve complex statistical calculations of risk, This can never be reduced to a pure science because of such unpredictable things as changes in behavior caused by the insurance itself, as well as differences among people who choose or do not choose to be insured against a given risk. Government regulation. Government regulation can either increase or decrease the risks faced by insurance companies and their customers. The power of government can be used to forbid some dangerous behavior, such as storing flammable liquids in schools or driving on tires with thin treads. This limits moral hazard, that is, how much additional risky behavior and its consequent damage may occur among people who are insured. Forcing everyone to have a given kind of insurance coverage, such as automobile insurance for all drivers, likewise eliminates the adverse selection problem. But government regulation of the insurance industry does not always bring net benefits, however, because there are other kinds of government regulation which increase risks and costs. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, for example, the federal government forced all banks to buy insurance that would reimburse depositors if their bank went bankrupt. There was no reason why banks could not have bought such insurance voluntarily before, but those banks which followed sufficiently cautious policies and which had a sufficient diversification of their assets that setbacks in some particular sector of the economy would not ruin them, found such insurance not worth paying for. Despite the thousands of banks that went out of business during the Great Depression, the vast majority of these were small banks with no branch offices. That is, their loans and their depositors were typically from a given geographic location, so that their risks were concentrated rather than diversified. None of the largest and most diversified banks failed. Forcing all banks and savings and loan associations to have deposit insurance eliminated the problem of adverse selection, but it increased the problem of moral hazard. That is, insured financial institutions could attract depositors who no longer worried about whether those institutions' policies were prudent or reckless, because deposits were insured up to a given amount, even if the bank or savings and loan association went bankrupt. In other words, those who managed these institutions no longer had to worry about depositors pulling their money out when the managements made risky investments. The net result was more risky behavior, moral hazard, which led to losses of more than $500 billion by savings and loan associations during the 1980s. Government regulation can also adversely affect insurance companies and their customers when insurance principles conflict with political principles. For example, arguments are often made, and laws passed accordingly, that it is unfair that a safe young driver is charged a higher premium because other young drivers have higher accident rates, or that young male drivers are charged more than female drivers the same age for similar reasons, or that people with similar driving records are charged different premiums according to where they live. A city attorney in Oakland, California, called a press conference in which he asked, "Why should a young man in the Fruitvale pay 30% more for insurance than someone living in another community? How can this be fair?" he demanded. Implicit in such political arguments is the notion that it is wrong for people to be penalized for things that are not their fault. But insurance is about risk, not fault, and risks are greater when you live where your car is more likely to be stolen, vandalized, or wrecked in a collision with local drag racers. Fraudulent insurance claims also differ from one location to another, with insurance premiums being higher in places where such fraud is more prevalent. Thus, the same insurance coverage for the same car can vary from city to city, and even from one part of the same city to another. The same automobile insurance coverage that costs $5,162 in Detroit costs $3,225 in Los Angeles and $948 in Green Bay. The same insurance coverage for the same car costs more in Brooklyn than in Manhattan, because Brooklyn has been one of the hotspots for insurance fraud. These are all risks that differ from one place to another with a given driver. Forcing insurance companies to charge the same premiums to groups of people with different risks means that premiums must rise overall, with safer groups subsidizing those who are either more dangerous in themselves or who live where they are vulnerable to more dangerous other people, or where insurance fraud rings operate. In the case of automobile insurance, This also means that more unsafe drivers can afford to be on the road, so that their victims pay the highest and most unnecessary price of all in injuries and deaths. Concern for politically defined fairness over risk also led to a 95-0 vote in the United States Senate in 2003 for a bill banning insurance companies from discriminating against people whose genetic tests showed them to have a higher risk of certain diseases. It is certainly not these people's fault that their genes happen to be what they are, but insurance premiums are based on risk, not fault. Laws forbidding risks to be reflected in insurance premiums and coverage mean that premiums in general must rise, not only to cover higher uncertainties when knowledge of certain risks is banned, but also to cover the cost of increased litigation from policyholders who claim discrimination, whether or not such claims turn out to be true. Such political thinking is not peculiar to the United States. Charging different premiums by sex is banned in France, and efforts have been made to extend this ban to other countries in the European Union. In a free market, premiums paid for insurance or annuities would reflect the fact that men have more car accidents and women live longer. Therefore, men would pay more for car insurance and life insurance in general, while women would pay more for an annuity providing the same annual income as an annuity for men, since that amount would usually have to be paid for more years for a woman. Unisex insurance and annuities would cost more total money than insuring the sexes separately and charging them different amounts for given insurance or annuities. That is because, with one sex subsidizing the other, an insurance company's profit and loss situation would be very different if more women than expected bought annuities or more men than expected bought life insurance. Since those who buy insurance or annuities choose which companies to buy from, no given company can know in advance how many women or men will buy their insurance or annuities, even though their own profit or loss depends on which sex buys what. In other words, there would be more financial risk to selling unisex insurance policies and annuities, and this additional risk would have to be covered by charging higher prices for both products. Government insurance. Government programs that deal with risk are often analogized to insurance, or may even be officially called insurance without in fact being insurance. For example, the National Flood Insurance Program in the United States insures homes in places too risky for a real insurance company and charges premiums far below what would be necessary to cover the costs, so that taxpayers cover the remainder. In addition, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, helps victims of floods, hurricanes, and other natural disasters to recover and rebuild. Far from being confined to helping people struck by unpredictable disasters, FEMA also helps affluent resort communities, built in areas known in advance to face high levels of danger. As a former mayor of one such community, Emerald Isle, North Carolina, put it, "Emerald Isle basically uses FEMA as an insurance policy. Shielded by heavily subsidized financial protection, many vulnerable coastal communities have been built along the North Carolina shore." As the Washington Post reported, "In the past two decades, beach towns have undergone an unprecedented building boom, transforming sleepy fishing villages into modern resorts. Land values have doubled and tripled, with oceanfront lots selling for $1 million or more. Quaint shore cottages have been replaced by hulking rentals with 10 bedrooms, game rooms, elevators, whirlpool bathtubs, and pools. All this has been made possible by the availability of government money to replace all this vulnerable and expensive real estate built on a shore often struck by hurricanes. After one such hurricane, FEMA bought an estimated $15 million worth of sand to replace sand washed away from the beach in the storm," according to the Washington Post. Unlike real insurance, such programs as FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program do not reduce the overall risks. Often, people rebuild homes and businesses in the well-known paths of hurricanes and floods, often to the applause of the media for their courage. But the financial risks created are not paid by those who create them, as with insurance, but are instead paid by the taxpayers. What this means is that the government makes it less expensive for people to live in risky places, and more costly to society as a whole when people distribute themselves in more risky patterns than they would do if they had to bear the costs themselves, either in higher insurance premiums or in financial losses and anxieties. Television reporter John Stossel's experience was typical. In 1980, I built a beach house, a wonderful one, 4 bedrooms, every room with a view of the Atlantic Ocean. It was an absurd place to build. It was on the edge of the ocean. All that stood between my house and ruin was 100 feet of sand. My father told me, "Don't do it, it's too risky. No one should build so close to an ocean." But I built anyway. Why? As my eager for the business architect said, "Why not? If the ocean destroys your house, the government will pay for a new one." 4 years later, the ocean surged in and ruined the first floor of Mr. Stossel's house, and the government replaced it. Then, a decade after that, the ocean came in again, and this time it wiped out the whole house. The government then paid for the entire house and its contents. John Stossel described the premiums he paid for coverage under the National Flood Insurance Program as dirt cheap, while the same coverage from a private insurance company would undoubtedly have been prohibitively expensive. But this is not a program for low-income people. It covers mansions in Malibu and vacation homes owned by wealthy families in Hyannis and Kennebunkport. The National Flood Insurance Program is, in fact, the largest property insurer in the country. More than 25,000 properties have received flood insurance payments from the federal government on more than 4 different occasions each. One property in Houston was flooded 16 times, requiring more than $800,000 worth of repairs, several times the value of the property itself. It was one of more than 4,500 properties whose insurance payments exceeded the value of the property during the period from 1978 to 2006. There is an almost irresistible political inclination to provide disaster relief to people struck by earthquakes, wildfires, tornadoes, and other natural disasters, as well as providing money to rebuild. The tragic pictures on television override any consideration of what the situation was when they decided to live where disaster victims did. The cost of rebuilding New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina struck has been estimated to be enough to pay every New Orleans family of 4 $800,000, which they could use to relocate to some safer place if they wished. But no such offer is likely to be made, either in New Orleans or in other places subject to predictable and recurrent natural disasters ranging from wildfires to hurricanes. Even when there is no current natural disaster, just the prospect of such a disaster often evokes calls for government subsidies, as in a New York Times editorial. With premiums rising relentlessly and insurers cutting hundreds of thousands of homeowner policies from the Gulf of Mexico up the East Coast to Florida and Long Island, there is a real danger that millions might soon be unable to purchase insurance. That's a compelling argument for government help. Such arguments proceed as if the only real issue is covering the cost of damage, rather than reducing the risk of damage in the first place by not locating in dangerous places. Private insurance provides incentives to relocate by charging higher premiums for dangerous locations. But government-imposed price controls on insurance companies have had predictable results. As the same editorial noted, private insurers have jacked up premiums as much as they can, and, when barred from raising prices, dropped coverage of riskier homes. Disaster relief from the government differs from private payments from insurance companies in another way. Competition among insurance companies involves not only price, but service. When floods, hurricanes, or other disasters strike an area, insurance company A cannot afford to be slower than insurance company B in getting money to their policyholders. Imagine a policyholder whose home has been destroyed by a flood or hurricane and who is still waiting for his insurance agent to show up, while his neighbor's insurance agent arrives on the scene within hours to advance a few $1,000s immediately so that the family can afford to go find shelter somewhere. Not only will the customer of the tardy insurance company be likely to change companies afterward, so will people all across the country if word gets out as to who provides prompt service and who drags their feet. For the tardy insurance company, that can translate into losing billions of dollars worth of business nationwide. The lengths to which some insurance companies go to avoid being later than competing insurance companies was indicated by a New York Times story. Prepared for the worst, some insurers had cars equipped with global positioning systems to help navigate neighborhoods with downed street signs and missing landmarks, and many claims adjusters carried computer-produced maps identifying the precise location of every customer. After the catastrophic Hurricane Katrina struck New Orleans in 2005, the difference between private and governmental responses was reported in the Wall Street Journal. The private sector planning began before Katrina hit. Home Depot's War Room had transferred high-demand items, generators, flashlights, batteries, and lumber, to distribution areas surrounding the strike area. Phone companies readied mobile cell towers and sent in generators and fuel. Insurers flew in special teams and set up hotlines to process claims. The same difference in response time was observed in the recovery after Katrina. In August 2005, Hurricane Katrina flattened two bridges, one for cars, one for trains, that spanned the 2 miles of water separating this city of 8,000 from the town of Pass Christian. 16 months later, the automobile bridge remains little more than pilings. The railroad bridge is busy with trains. The difference, the still wrecked bridge is owned by the U.S. government. The other is owned by railroad giant CSX Corporation of Jacksonville, Florida. Within weeks of Katrina's landfall, CSX dispatched construction crews to fix the freight line. 6 months later, the bridge reopened. Even a partial reopening of the road bridge, part of U.S. Highway 90, is at least 5 months away. The kind of market competition which forces faster responses in the private sector is, of course, lacking in government emergency programs, which have no competitors. They may be analogized to insurance, but do not have the same incentives or results. Political incentives can even delay getting aid to victims of natural disasters. When there were thousands of deaths in the wake of a huge cyclone that struck India in 1999, it was reported in that country's press that the government was unwilling to call on international agencies for help, for fear that this would be seen as admitting the inadequacies of India's own government. The net result was that many villages remained without either aid or information 2 weeks after the disaster.